Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Banking Matters. I'm your host, Lindsay Hughley, and joining me today is Kathy Craninger. Hi, Kathy, and welcome back.
Hi, Lindsay. Thanks for having me.
Yes, so our conversation last week, we really just kind of dug in and looked at where you think the regulatory environment's kind of headed and kind of the disconnect between those regulations and the private sector of banking. And so I would really love to hear today, what are your thoughts as far as cybersecurity and data privacy? Where regulatory-wise, where do we have gaps? What are we doing well? Where do banks need to focus?
That is a big thing to take on, but it's fundamental. It absolutely is critical. When you think about, protection of money, the ability to have access to your funds, to transact when you want to transact, and that is one aspect of that, which is certainly in tension with having a vault. It gets you back to kind of the classic things we used to joke about growing up, but it's like, do you put your money in the mattress or do you put your money in a bank? And thankfully, we in this country feel our money is secure in a bank, and that's where it needs to stay. And the kind of confidence that we have in the system, it's really important. But as you start layering on, again, digital transactions, there are trade-offs. In one aspect, it is more secure. It is more secure than walking around with that briefcase of cash. We know that. That briefcase of cash gets stolen out of your hand, it's gone, and it's gone forever. But transactions that are digital, you can sometimes pull those back. There are clearing processes. There are delays in the system. Some right now still are a matter of mechanics and probably less necessary, but some are actually checks and balances and verification in the system. So there are, I think, real benefits to a lot of the electronic and digital banking that we are putting into place and having multi-factor authentication and truly knowing it's the person you're engaging with. But everything with technology is definitely a bit of an arms race, and you've got to be making sure that that is in fact the customer, that is the customer's wish. And so I mean so much to pull apart with this, but I could stop there for a moment and see where you'd like to take us.
So one thing that I would like to know is, as we've talked about in last week's episode, like from a community bank standpoint, that they do need to be keeping up with the times so that they can offer these items that their customers expect. And so more from a fintech partnership wise, but how does maintaining, the appropriate level of up with the times as far as technology goes and working through also making sure that things are safe and secure for our customers?
Yeah, I think first things first is the people you have, in place. Chief technology officer, chief information officer, chief information security officer, those kinds of roles and the expertise that they can bring, critical to have that good advice of people who understand the right questions to ask. I mean, look, as with anything in life, it evolves so quickly. You don't expect everyone to have to know absolutely everything. That's a completely illogical expectation. But the way to think about it, and so that also takes me to, it's a risk mitigation posture. It's understanding what the risks are. It's understanding what the appetite is. There is no 100% in life, in anything. If you put that money under your mattress, you could have a fire or anything else that happens. So it's not like it's a guarantee. It's all about risk mitigation and then understanding, what level of risk is still there and acknowledging that there is still going to be some risk. So that personnel. The partnerships piece is big too. There's only so much that each institution can build itself, but how are you connected to partners? What are those partners' responsibilities and your responsibilities for security, for privacy? And that's a big part of, again, the thought process of understanding this risk. And there's also a huge piece on information sharing and the environment at play. So what are, unfortunately, you know, private sector entities have to think about this. What are the threats from nation states? What are the threats from large organized crime? All of those outside forces that are seeking to do this, down to, you know, where is that fraudster who really just is engaged in scams that are, you know, really low level, but they're affecting your clients, your customers in a very personal and deep way when it comes to their money. So I think, you know, you've got to understand that threat environment. And thankfully, we do have mechanisms where institutions are helping each other, partnering with government, partnering with law enforcement to share what schemes are happening out there, what best practices are in terms of the basic level of capability that everyone needs to have in place, and even what's, you know, kind of best in class, who are the service providers that make sense. And so it's, you know, really a layered approach to the risk management that is a focus, I'm sure, of every conversation you have on this podcast, Lindsay. But that is at least the way I think about it, is the right people and the right kind of strategy and risk posture and the right tools and capabilities and the right information.
Absolutely. And so I will unashamedly admit that BSA is one of my favorite areas of banking. And so you bring up the information sharing piece. 314B, it's been around since 2011, and it just really has not, it's not very bulky. It's not very descriptive. But you have to stay within this narrow pathway of what you can and you can't communicate to another institution about. And so I am a little bit excited for some of the upcoming proposed rules as far as in regards to BSA from more of an AML CFT standpoint, because the industry standard has been this: you are required to have everything be risk-based, and yet there's been no real regulations gearing that. It's been more of just this expectation from examiners. And so do you have any insight on what you hope that looks like, what we're going to get soon?
Well, I think, I guess I'll take one step back too, because I think this is a great example of another area where we've created a massive paper tiger. And at the end of the day, is a lot of this reporting actually making customers safer, money safer, institutions safer, or are we really doing a whole bunch of reporting that is just overloading the government and not helping separate the wheat from the chaff here? So there is a massive amount of reporting that's happening on the BSA front, and frankly, not a lot of confidence that the government's looking at it. I mean, that again, you get to, like, you've got so many reports coming in, it's overwhelming. So how do we start doing that? A great example where technology and AI can help is analyzing that, actually honing in on it, and actually getting institutions' feedback. So I do have hope that, again, as the agencies are looking forward, they're examining what they've received in terms of transaction reports, and they're saying, you know what, okay, maybe let's actually reduce some of what we're getting to focus in and hone in on the things that are most valuable. We've got now decades of financial crime enforcement activity post 9/11, post Patriot Act, as you talk about the information sharing arena. You know, what is bearing fruit? What is not bearing fruit? What is truly suspicious activity? And really getting us to that information sharing where we're sharing the results with institutions so they can prevent it, rather than having law enforcement coming on the back end to have to, you know, litigate it, particularly when you're talking about the worst actors who are not in the U.S., they're overseas. And so I think there is a real ability for the government to come in and be a little more transparent about what is bearing fruit and what is not, and how we can work together to ensure that international partners are actually enforcing this in a way that is going to make the financial system globally, you know, more secure. So that is, I think there are some good opportunities here to look at this again.
Absolutely. And also, when you spoke about fraud and all of that, what is Florida Bankers Association? What have you guys done in the last year or so to kind of help your members to spread words, to connect them with appropriate agencies. What are y'all doing there?
Oh, it's a kind of all of the above strategy, if you will, on fraud, because we've got to counter fraud. We've got really, again, the billions. You've got the GDP of a pretty large nation at this point is what we're talking about in terms of money lost and leakage out of the U.S. Due to fraud. And so what you think about what that does to individuals, but you think about what that looks like collectively. So we at the Florida Bankers Association have launched a decent fraud effort that we're saying is legislative. You know, what are the things that we need to change with respect to Florida law? What do we need to push at the federal level? So we are absolutely developing that for the next Florida session, things around criminal penalties, things around information sharing. The next prong of this is definitely operational. We at the Florida Bankers Association actually launched FraudNet several decades ago. And so we're looking at it again. The concept then is still the concept now. How do we connect institutions to each other in terms of sharing what they're seeing on fraud with law enforcement to compare what they're seeing on fraud? And one of the things that's challenging about some of these crimes is they look disconnected. They look like there are individual victims and the amounts are so small in the aggregate that it's below law enforcement prosecution thresholds. It's below their investigation thresholds. But the amount of money writ large, and we know for a fact it's organized crime that's behind a lot of this too. So it is not isolated events and you know, if you will, you know, mom and pop swindlers. That is not what we're talking about writ large. And so how do we connect those crimes to each other and get them to a level where they're actually aggregating? And a lot of that is information sharing. It's focused investigative efforts. So there's an effort in Texas that is, I think, a great example for other states and something we are starting to talk to Florida officials about to see if Florida would be interested in having a financial crimes kind of task force or focused law enforcement group that we can work with. So that's another facet of it. Really all of the work that we've been doing as the financial system and private enterprise around check fraud and check clearing and check verification systems and things like that, much less transaction verification and any type of transaction you're engaging in, there is the opportunity for fraud. So getting to agreements between institutions about what's honored, what's not, what does this look like? But it's absolutely the case that we're seeing a lot more classic check fraud, whether it's washing or otherwise stealing checks from, you know, from the Postal Service too. So really tackling that with a lot of verification and capabilities between institutions. So those are just a few examples of the things that we at the Florida Bankers Association and the institutions with our national associations, ABA, ICBA, our counterparts in other states that we're looking at. And consumer education. I guess I'll end with that because it is, as I said, this is a multi-pronged approach. Consumers absolutely need that reminder. I think a lot of this fraud happens when people are most vulnerable or to people who are most vulnerable. I found it myself. You know, if you're getting busy and you see something come through and you're just saying yes, you got to stop and pause for a second and say, wait a minute, is that my bank asking me that? My bank doesn't ask that, you know, certainly doesn't do it by this means. So understanding again that all of us play a role in trying to prevent this.
Absolutely. We've seen just in our VCO group that we have our member banks there, we've seen such a large increase just in like elder financial exploitation. That's all that it can be summed up as. And so what's been wild is we have banks across the entire country and the schemes have been the exact same. And when my banks have been involved in that, my main thing is getting in your community, because how else are we going to be trying to reach? And community banks are a cornerstone of these communities. And that when I see one bank struggling with one of their customers, and then they're concerned about other customers of that same demographic, I have just encouraged them, get out in your community, go and do little workshops with that targeted demographic, go and communicate with them, get with your state associations to see what options that you guys will have, because the passion that I've heard from the last couple of state associations that I've been able to talk with, to be able to empower their banks to combat against all of this fraud, it's been awesome. You guys have really, you guys are working so hard to do, make the right steps for your members for sure. And it's clearly seen.
Thank you. It's important. As I said, all of the above, we've got to do something to start making this harder and harder, raising the bar for organized crime, raising the bar for those who are seeking to take advantage of people. And I mean, it's sad cases, as you mentioned, elder fraud too. I mean, some of it is inside the family. Some of it is children and nieces and nephews and siblings. And that part's incredibly sad and hard. Unfortunately requires, you know, a different strategy than some of these things that are organized crime and are strangers perpetrating the fraud. But you can't even get to that because of all of the other things that are coming at us. There are a lot of different factors to it.
Yes, it's a lot. And so as we wrap up, I really would love to hear one piece of advice that you would like to leave our listeners with.
As a lifelong learner, I would say that's always what I say. I've come to find in my public sector career and my life that you've got to constantly be curious. You've got to challenge your own assumptions. You've got to really think about really where someone else might be coming from, what else they may know or bring to bear to something, even when you feel like you know it well. Because I've come to find the more I know about a topic, it's the more I realize I don't know. And so that continual curiosity and lifelong learning is something that pushes me and really helps me keep focus and keep improving. So I can offer that, be a lifelong learner.
Awesome. And I fully agree. One of my supervisors that I've had, that was his thing. No one can ever take your education or anything that you learn away from you. And we got several of our certifications together, and he has continued to just amass. But he's so, like you said, he's curious. He loves to lock all of that in. And so I'm in full support of that. But thank you, Kathy, so much for your time and for speaking with us. And for the rest of our listeners, that's Banking Matters.